Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to The Longest Night. We are a Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon show on the Podbreed Network. My name is Rob, and I have seen every single episode of Game of Thrones at least half a dozen times, and I've read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
And my name is Lizzie. I've also seen every single episode of Game of Thrones, but I haven't read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
If you want to, you can find us on Twitter. We are at LongestNightGOT. That is at LongestNightGOT. Our title music was written and provided by Edward Thomas. You can find all of his available work in the description. I just want to make it known, I'm sure you will have all realised by now, that Jay is not going to be with us for this episode. We tried to get our schedules together, but it turns out we were all busy at different points, and so our episode was first of all, it was delayed, and then we thought, oh, we'll just get together later in the week, and then that wasn't really possible either. Yeah. So never mind. All right then, let's get on with the rest of the episode. This week, we are going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 10, the finale of House of the Dragon, and it's called The Black Queen. It was written by show creator Ryan Condal and directed by Greg Yatanis. It was first broadcast on the 23rd of October, 2022, to, I don't know, an audience of whatever size. Oh, yeah, they actually released it this time.
Oh, did they?
It was watched by 9.3 million people on all services.
Okay.
Yeah, they do it for the finale in the first episode. I think it was just so that they could go like, oh, it's the biggest season finale on HBO since Game of Thrones.
And also as a way of proving like, hey, we've retained that many viewers and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. It's the problem with only having viewership data inside the network that actually publishes and broadcasts the episode. Like, you know, it's not up to Nielsen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, they kind of have it, you know, HBO have their streaming viewing figures, and we're just gonna have to put up with the fact that we we're not gonna get the full data, but never mind. Lizzie, the Black Queen, what do we make of this season finale?
Yeah, really good finale for the most part. Definitely liked it a lot more than last week. I'm surprised they kind of bookended the series so perfectly with horrific childbirth scenes. But
yeah,
aside from that, it does feel like we've really gotten going now. And I think in last week's episode, I was kind of, in terms of season two, I was like, yeah, I'm sort of looking forward to it. I can kind of take it or leave it. Now I'm just like fully strapped in, like, yep, here we go. This is it. This is our Franz Ferdinand moment.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree there. I'm sort of in the same boat as you. I really enjoyed this. It's not been my favourite episode of the season like it has been for some people.
Oh, no.
I think out there. But again, it does a clever little thing at the end of the episode where it just notices a gap in George R. R. Martin's story and just goes, ah, but what if? And yeah, I've always liked it when the show has done that up to this point. So yeah, looking forward to getting into it.
Grandsire was the greatest sailor who ever lived. I get greensick before the ship even leaves the harbour. I'll just ruin everything. I don't want Driftmark. It should have passed on to Sir Vaymond.
We don't choose our destiny, Luke. It chooses us.
Grandsire, let you choose whether you be his heir. You told us so.
And do you want to know the truth of it?
I was frightened.
I was
4 and 10.
Same as you are now. I wasn't ready to be Queen of the Seven Kingdoms. But it was my duty. And in time, I came to understand I had to earn my inheritance.
In part one, on Dragonstone, Rhaenyra attempts to reassure her son, Luke, that he is worthy of ruling Driftmark if Corlys Velaryon should die from his fever. Princess Rhaenys then arrives at Dragonstone to inform Rhaenyra that her father, Viserys, is dead, and that the Greens have crowned Aegon as his successor. The news sends Rhaenyra into a premature labour and she gives birth to a stillborn child. While Rhaenyra is in labour, Daemon plans the defence of the island from any attack by the Greens. At the funeral for Rhaenyra's child, Sir Eric Cargill arrives from King's Landing bearing the golden crown of King Viserys, and he swears fealty to Rhaenyra as she is crowned the Queen on Dragonstone and styles herself the Black Queen, which is the name of the episode. And everybody's doing the Leo point right now.
Oh, yeah.
So this first half of the episode, plot content isn't that heavy, but that's absolutely fine. It means that we get a lot of character content. So, what do we make of this kind of opening salvo with Rhaenyra and coming and chatting to Luke, and then Rhaenys turns up and it's like, ah, here's what's happened last week. She kind of gives us the recap.
Yeah, poor Luke. I guess I'll say it straight up front. I'm really going to miss Luke because I feel like he provided quite a relatable character in that camp of just like, well, how would you deal with that situation if you're so young and you're being thrust into this position of power that you don't really understand and you don't feel like you have any kind of, any right to really be there. And yeah, you really feel it in this scene, just the panic of like, oh God, how am I supposed to do this? Because I don't know, there's no book I'm supposed to read on it. There's not like a manual. And yeah, for it to be thrusted on you so suddenly when, you know, you haven't necessarily been bred for that in the same way that, you know, Aegon and Aemond might be, then yeah, I feel terrible for him.
Yeah, I think this scene, it puts in a lot of work, the one with him and Rhaenyra, it puts in a lot of work, I think, because Rhaenyra and Luke haven't been seen on screen together alone much this season. And so
I kind of knew
that the episode was going to end in the way that it did. Obviously, I definitely knew because, you know, I've read the book, and unless they kicked off next season with it, it was either going to be the end of this episode or the start of season two that they were going to kick everything off with. So I was looking for scenes like this, you know, as we went through the season and we didn't really spend as much time with Luke as I thought, because he has, you know, his death is like the big igniting incident of the conflict. I was waiting for them to build him up a little bit more, but then this scene arrives and you put in quite a lot of, it does put in quite a lot of work, and I'm glad that you've sort of taken away from it that you're gonna miss him, because, you know, the characters, I think, you know, there are so many characters in the show and they're all kind of fighting for screen time. And so when you end up in a situation like that, you always run the risk, I suppose, of if a big death happens in a massive ensemble show like this, you run the risk of it not coming across. But I think you've made the point there quite clearly that people who are new to this story are still able to connect with it on an emotional level. And if you feel like you're going to miss the character, then, you know, as kind of slight as their work has been up to this point, I think Luke's presence in this episode does a lot of, it puts in a lot of effort to make sure that something is felt by the time he goes. When Rhaenys turns up and she's addressing the end of episode 9, I did smile a little bit, because all through the week before this episode, which now feels a bit like ancient history because we've waited a week to talk about the episode and that sort of thing, and it's been a few days since I've actually watched it, when that week before the final episode that was just filled with, I mean, it's obviously just social media and I hate it, and it's all nonsense, and discourse around anything is annoying if you read enough people's opinions about it. But, you know, a lot of people were unhappy with the fact that Rhaenys acted in ways that they didn't, you know, that the audience, some of the audience weren't anticipating, you know, it's stupid. I've seen some people doing things like, oh, that was Game of Thrones season 8 level of writing and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just kind of, okay, I guess that's the default for like things we don't like now, which is just, oh, it was season 8 quality. That was stupid. And it was all pretty nicely explained, I thought, by Sarah Hess and Claire Kilner, who was sort of like, well, you know, she wants to break free because she's a prisoner. but she doesn't believe that it's her place to start the war.
That's right. I think sort of deep down as well, she kind of wants Rhaenyra to prove that she wants it.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, Alicent didn't kill her while they had her under lock and key. And so she thought, all right, everybody gets one chance. This is my way of sort of saying, I'm not going to take any shit, but also, like, it's not really my war to start. So let's not do that, hey? And so the first thing that she says in this episode is basically like, well, Rhaenyra says, why didn't you just kill them all? And Rhaenys is like, as if that's my place. It's not my place to start this. And it's just like, they haven't, but it does feel like they've gone back in and specifically done this scene just to address the criticisms of the previous week. And it's just, it does speak to how, like, and I mean that in a good way, by the way, because it means that the writers have already anticipated things that people could say. And so they've put this scene in already before even people have started complaining. And it does kind of back up a theory I have that when people have more time to think about TV shows, they tend to dislike them more these days because we get so used to the habit of just having, you know, if we're watching three episodes at a time, if you finish episode 9 and then immediately go into episode 10, you'll probably think, why didn't she just kill them for about 3 minutes? And then you'll start the next episode. And then your problem that you had with it gets solved because, of course, she explained it. Like, you know, it's not her place to start the war. Fine. But when you have a week to stew on it and go on the internet and talk about it, it becomes enshrined in your head. And it's like this immovable thing now where it's like, she didn't kill them because the writing is stupid. And like, she wouldn't do that. She wouldn't behave this way. And like, I think if it's just one of those where if they were watching it straight afterwards, that complaint maybe never would have come up.
Yeah, but it's like at that point, we've not seen any evidence that Rhaenys is that way inclined to kill people when she feels that injustice has been done. Mm.
Yeah, exactly.
She's not Daemon, you know.
Well, even in this episode, skipping ahead a little bit, still in this main part of the episode, she's the only person who doesn't bend the knee when Rhaenyra is crowned. She stands up because she's like, well, I'm kind of on your side, but like, you know, I'm sort of neutral about it. At least at the early part of the episode, things change a little bit as the story goes on this week. But obviously that news that Viserys is dead and Aegon has been crowned triggers our third childbirth scene of the season. And what did you make of this third one, this third childbirth?
I think it's like it's somehow the most horrific. And they've all been pretty horrific in their own way. Like, they're all kind of varying levels of violent and, you know, not really holding anything back. But this in particular, like, what a performance by Emma Darcy.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And, like, this is, you know, I think we were saying, like, with late period Game of Thrones, how does this kind of focus on moments and, like, moments that would cross over into, you know, streams where people who don't necessarily know the show or watch the show might come across it and think, oh, wow, what's this? Like, because I'm pretty sure this, like, you know, my mum doesn't watch the show. I think she tried Game of Thrones season 1, but didn't really get on with it. And because of this scene, I think she'd seen it on Facebook or something. She's like, yeah, maybe I'll check this out.
Oh, cool.
And it's like, yeah, I've definitely seen some stuff this week, which is more along the lines of it was gratuitous and they should be more sensitive about it. But I don't really agree with that line of thought. I think the brutality of it is the point. And I don't know whether it was the news of Viserys or the news of Aegon that caused the premature birth or the both, the kind of 1-2 punch of it. But yeah, it's horrible and it's extremely effective and you don't forget it. Like, you will not forget the scene of the baby just kind of dropping onto a pool of blood and the sound it makes. And yeah, it's horrible.
Mm. Yeah, I've been looking ahead to this scene for quite a while because I was curious. Obviously, by the point that Rhaenyra is crowned in the book, she has, like, loads of children. And
yeah.
There was talk in the promotional stuff by Miguel and Ryan before the show started where they were talking about how there's a lot of birth scenes in the first season. And I was just sort of thinking to myself, like, how are they going to do so many birth scenes and not make them really repetitive and quite dull
And
how are they going to have them be suitably dramatic when you keep going back to them? And it turns out the first way that they got to this conclusion with the way that they've done the birth scenes is to skip over some of them so that they don't become routine for the viewer. You know, they've kept them fairly far apart, you know, right at the start of the season, then at the start of the time jump, then at the very end of the season. And they've all been very different in their own ways. You know, we have in the first birth scene, we have the mother is killed. Then in the second birth scene, it's more about the implication. It's the implications in that birth scene, the things that kind of happen off screen, where like when Rhaenyra is giving birth, there's a lot of squelching, but you don't see anything. And then you see her walking, but you don't really see the effects until after she's gone with the blood on the floor and all of this. Like, you know, there's loads of little things like that. And then, but then with this third one, it's the, you know, they've kind of flip reversed it where it's like, it's the child that dies this time. And each one of them has been graphic in their own way. You know, it's interesting as well that I think that Miguel Sapochnik did the first two birth scenes and Greg Yatanis did this third one. And it's interesting how they view them through the camera differently to one another. With this one, I just think that it's finally brought home for me something that I was a little bit concerned about during the time jump period, where it felt like they were missing an opportunity to sit with Rhaenyra and feel the implications of what childbirth represents to her. And this idea about squeezing out heirs that she said earlier, and the fact that she always sees childbirth and labour and pregnancy as a prison when she wants to be free. And so when I thought they were kind of skimming over those details a little bit during the midpoint of the season, it feels like they've really brought it home now. And it's a really good parallel to her own mother's death, which is something that always hung over her and she was always scared about, especially because it was something that, you know, if a man decided to have his way, she couldn't get out of. You know, there's no option to get, you know, there's no option to terminate pregnancies. There's no option to get out of pregnancy. And I totally agree with you, Lizzie, that this is not gratuitous. It's very bloody and very gory, and it's uncomfortable, and it might make some people a bit squeamish, but that, you know, to quote Lady Bird, just because something is ugly doesn't mean it's morally wrong. And so I would say that to have this scene be so frank and be so open, I think, you know, always warn people. I have a friend whose partner's recently given birth, and he said that they had to skip through the scene with Emma in the first episode. And so I've just kind of forewarned him about the one in episode 6 and the one in episode 10, because he's catching up now that it's all over. But that's fine if your personal reaction to it is, oh, that's a bit uncomfortable for me. But if it extends beyond that to say this scene shouldn't be in there, then it becomes another discussion entirely. And it assumes that the viewer is the voice of authority in this situation, which I don't think is necessarily the best way to go about things. But I do think that this is the most, my reaction to this scene was the most visceral to any of the birth scenes so far. Yeah. The first time I ever watched the birthing scene for Emma where she dies, I got quite choked up the first time I ever watched that. I winced a little bit during Rhaenyra's, whereas with this one, it was a bit of both. I was wincing at quite a lot of the visuals on screen. Big shout out to the practical effects team, by the way. Like,
oh yeah, totally.
Always a big fan of practical effects, and they're fantastic in this episode. The moment that really got me was when like that soupy blood just like went onto the floor beneath her, while the midwives are like, please just let us help you. And then like, I mean, obviously this didn't actually happen, but like, there's almost this implication, I think, that when Rhaenyra is reaching underneath herself to pull it out, it's almost like she knows that the child isn't alive. And so she's just kind of like pulling it out anyway. And then when you get the model of the baby on the floor with the placenta wrapped around its neck and stuff like that, there's like little dents in its head that sort of makes it seem like she pulled too hard. And that's really violent stuff that they've put on screen there. And I don't know if that's actually the intention, but that's kind of how it came across to me.
I'm guessing it is.
It's it really got a proper reaction out of me. I was surprised that, like, you know, we're three birth scenes deep now in the show, and I'm glad that they've found a way to bring it full circle before the end of the season. This worry that Rhaenyra has always had that her mother's death would come back to get her and she would die the same way when she was having children and stuff like that. But now she realises that maybe the greatest tragedy of all isn't necessarily to die yourself, but to go on living after a child has been killed. There's something that Emma Darcy's actually said this week where they were in an interview talking about how in this episode, Rhaenyra learns that there are new ways to experience grief. You know, she loses her dad and two children in one episode. And yeah. she's already lost a mum and adjusted to that one way. Now she's lost her dad. Then she loses her daughter. And now she would lose her... And then later in the episode, she loses her son. So, like, ugh, you know, it's a lot for her. And in this moment, they choose to crown Rhaenyra. I don't know if you have anything about the crowning scene.
It feels like, I don't know, a Pyrrhic victory at this point.
Massive.
It's kind of, it's just like out of a sense of duty rather than out of genuine want, because I think, as much as like Rhaenyra obviously does have that kind of want to take the throne because it's her right and it was promised to her by her father, I think by this point, with everything that's happened with you know, with the birth, it's just like it doesn't matter anymore. And it does just feel like duty rather than anything resembling an actual desire for it.
Yeah, it's something that she says to Luke earlier in the episode, that, isn't it? Where she says, you know, I didn't necessarily want to be heir, but I just carried on because it was my duty. And you'll have to learn that too. You know, people will expect things of you and you'll have to go through with them because of the trust that they've placed in you. And you have to pay respect to that trust. And I imagine similar thoughts are kind of going through her head when she's being crowned. Totally we know what you mean about the Pyrrhic victory. It's not a big triumphant thing necessarily. It feels like a culmination, but it feels like it's something that Game of Thrones always did very well, which is like, it's a culmination that's slightly off balance, where you kind of get what you want, but not really in the way that you intended, or not really in the way that you were expecting. You know,
Yeah, it's not a substitute for the real thing. It's almost like a consolation prize.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like, just to compare it to another coronation scene, it feels a little bit like Jon Snow's at the end of season 6, where it's like,
yeah,
you get totally a big celebratory moment like, yeah, King of the North, woo, but Jon is not happy about it. And then Sansa looks over at Littlefinger and it's like already Littlefinger is working to undermine him. Like the second that somebody's crowned, it's like, oh, okay, maybe this won't end in the way that we thought. And it's the same with Rhaenyra here, where she gets the crown put on her head and you get her theme coming back from early in the season. The thing that comes up in the background. It's one of the few motifs.
Oh, Superman.
Oh, I want to play that at the end of the episode. I'll have that players out. That's a great song. But
totally.
Yeah. And so... Yeah, I totally know what you mean about it feeling like a Pyrrhic victory. And then when Rhaenys is the one who doesn't bow and doesn't bend the knee, it does feel a little bit like, okay, everybody's here, but not everybody's completely on side yet either. So maybe that's another task for you, Rhaenyra. It's like, you know, your arc has finally culminated, but the job has only just begun. And then she takes it forward into the next bit of the episode.
Yeah, and you wonder if at this point Rhaenyra would kind of rather be an observer like Rhaenys than be thrust into this position and all while carrying this burden of grief like a fucking giant sack of it, having to cart it along while she does her duty. Like, yeah, you probably would want to be on the fringes just biding your time, because that's an advantageous position, I think. You're sort of in the driving seat. You're in control of your own destiny.
Acknowledge Aegon as king and swear obeisance before the Iron Throne. In exchange, his grace will confirm your possession of Dragonstone. It will pass to your true-born son, Lyseris, upon your death. Lyseris will be confirmed as the legitimate heir to Driftmark and all the lands and holdings of House Velaryon. Your sons by Prince Daemon, will also be given places of high honor at court. Aegon the Younger as the king's squire, Viserys as his cupbearer. Finally, the king in his good grace will pardon any knight or lord who conspired against his ascent.
I would rather feed my sons to the dragons than have them carry shields and cups for your drunken usurper cunt of a king.
In part two, Rhaenyra and Daemon gather for their first war council since Rhaenyra's crowning. Daemon outlines their strategy and tells her that he intends to claim the wild dragons that are living under Dragonstone. The council is then informed that Otto Hightower has arrived on the island. He brings terms from Aegon and Alicent that state if Rhaenyra bends the knee to Aegon, they will recognise her ownership of Dragonstone and allow it to pass to her children. When a fight is about to break out, Rhaenyra calls for an end to the hostilities and promises Otto that he will receive her terms the next day. Back at the War Council, Daemon is angry with Rhaenyra for not wanting to respond aggressively to the Greens' coup. Daemon then attempts to sort of like strangle Rhaenyra when she tells him about Aegon the Conqueror's Song of Ice and Fire, which is a prophecy that Viserys never informed Daemon about. Okay, so we get this War Council and stuff, and Otto Hightower turns up. The only little observations I made about this scene is that it's kind of funny watching Rhaenyra adjust to everybody treating her like a queen. Like,
yeah,
where she's like, oh yeah, people just give me wine now and people just follow me about because they have to, and oh, this is all a bit strange. And anyway, lads, what's the, what's the war council doing? You know, let me know what your plan is. And then we find out through this scene as well, the second note I had, that this feels a bit like it's Daemon's war. Like, we get that sense when he's planning the strategy, and it's sort of like, right, listen, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. And then when Otto turns up, it's like, right, let me have him. It's like all of a sudden it becomes Daemon's little playground. I don't know if you have any further kind of notes about this area of the episode.
Just a really quick note. I love the table lit up in orange. Like, why didn't Stannis ever use that?
Yeah, that's a bit of a shame that they couldn't do that in Game of Thrones. I guess, like, the, it just wasn't something that ever really entered their heads, but, like, it's great. I absolutely love it. Yeah, the fire underneath the table to make it glow that extra little bit. Like, I mean, by the time it reaches Game of Thrones, that table has moved. It's moved to a different room, and so maybe they left it behind. But yeah, it's a lovely little touch. It's a gorgeous design.
Or maybe Stannis just enjoys the darkness.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe. Who knows? But yeah, I totally get what you're saying about this feeling like Daemon's war, and also feeling like Daemon's premiership, the way he treats Rhaenyra in this. Just, it is this kind of sense of, you might be queen, but don't forget who's sort of twisting the knobs around here and who's driving the situation forward. And yeah, it again, going back to this thing of, you know, you're queen, but at what cost? It's like, are you really even the queen of anything if you're being pushed around by your uncle?
Yeah, some people have kind of complained, Daemon stands have complained about Daemon's characterization a little bit this season, that they've things have been cut out that make Daemon seem like a nicer guy. But I think the second that you murder somebody that you don't have time for anymore, it doesn't really matter how much good stuff you're shown doing afterwards, there's still that stain, and there's still that capability that's present, where Daemon is very much similar, I think, to Targaryens we've seen in the past, who come along later in the show, where they're capable of greatness, but they're also capable of great cruelty as well.
Absolutely. And they can be horrible, but they're not always the most horrible person in the room.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's kind of Daemon. You know, he's capable of great evil and great cruelty, but he's also, you know, he's a bit of a family man, and he cares deeply about his family. And I think this is maybe something that we find a bit complicated to discuss when it comes to perpetrators of abuse, which is that perpetrators of abuse aren't necessarily terrible people all the way through. You know, it's like that they have moments of compassion, and this is why they're able to, I imagine in some cases, it's why people are able to perpetrate abuse, because there's another side to them that they show to everybody else, and it's how they get away with it. And it means that they have good parts and evil parts, and those evil parts sometimes are just stronger. And I think it's the case with Daemon. And, like, you know, in episode 4, it was like when he was taking her through King's Landing, and it was openly acknowledged by quite a lot of the cast and the crew and the fans and stuff that it was a grooming situation. And so to get to this point where Rhaenyra was a bit older, I think Daemon has always seen himself as the person who is the real authority behind Rhaenyra. You know, he's happy for her to take thrones and do stuff like this, but as long as he gets to do what he wants and exert dominance over her in other ways, then he'll be fine with that. And just at the point where he thinks, right, great, I can plan her war for her, this is great, he finds out that, or maybe he believes now that his brother Viserys always put Rhaenyra first. He told Rhaenyra about the prophecy, but not Daemon. And so Daemon, in a moment of insecurity, goes back to the thing that he always does in a moment of insecurity, because as we've been describing him on the show, you know, he is a massive baby, and this is the way that he strikes out, and it's with violence, and it's with just remember. You know, it's like that's what it feels like to me when he has his hand around her neck. It's like, just remember who's really in charge here. You might be wearing the crowns, you might know all the prophecies, but if we win this war, it'll be because of me, not because of you. And Daemon is a character who seems very capable of that. And Daemon, I don't know, Daemon's always to me been very grey and shades of grey. And, you know, he has some darker shades. And fair play to Ryan Condal, by the way, for coming out and sort of having a go at these people, saying, like, you know, I see people on social media saying, like, we're doing this wrong or we're doing that wrong. And it's like, everything we do goes through George, and so if you think you know Daemon better than me and George, then, you know, send us an email, why don't you? You know, complain, you know, complain to us, we'll listen. You know, it's like, who knows Daemon better than the person who created him and the person who's creating him for the show?
Exactly.
Nobody, so, you know.
It's like, you want to write your own fanfic? Sure, be my guest, you know. Do what you want. But yeah, I totally agree that Daemon has always been that kind of shades of grey character, and that sometimes, like, yeah, he's like an equal opportunities abuser.
Yeah, that's absolutely what he is. The other little detail I like, just going back to the painted table, it was very nice to hear about House Arryn, the Lannisters, Winterfell, Riverrun, the Vale, like the... Basically, in season 2, the map is going to expand. It's going to look more like and resemble more Game of Thrones next season, I think, because it will no longer just be about King's Landing and Dragonstone. It's, you know, other houses have to start, you know, there's allies that are going to get involved now because there's a war that's broken out. And so we're going to have to meet these allies, and we're going to have to go and visit these allies. And if one castle or house declares for another house, then the enemy side might have something to say about that, and they might go and visit them. And so there's going to be a bit of, you know, there's going to be a bit of conflict and a bit of map hopping and a little bit of journeying around. And it's good that the show is managing itself this way, where it's just ever so slightly teased an expanding map and an expanding story as we've gone along. And now it feels like it's ready. And so we get that with the shots of the painted table kind of snaking over Winterfell and Riverrun and all these different places that we know so well. And so hearing these names mentioned and everything like that was a bit lovely, to be honest. I don't know if it's just a little bit of the fan service lover in me that, like, I just wanted to hear things that I knew. But yeah, the map's going to expand, and this was a nice way to warn people about it, I think. You start mentioning these names that they recognise. I have to say as well, though, we've just talking about Daemon's dark side. He has one of my favourite lines of the episode, at least in terms of delivery, where Otto turns up and they're having that argument. He goes, "Let's end this mummer's farce." And it's just the way that he says it is like proper villain catchphrase. I'm a really big fan of that. It's a nice kind of parallel between this episode and episode 2. When Otto and Daemon go to, well, they come to blows on the steps at Dragonstone, and then Rhaenyra turns up on a dragon and calls it down. I don't know. I don't know if necessarily about that scene in particular, but there's a moment in that scene that I was a little bit like, Are people going to remember this? Which is the page from the book. Do you remember this? The origins of that?
Go on.
Well, it was in episode one when they were reading together under the tree. The Rhaenyra and Alicent, I like this position scene. And a page gets ripped out of the book that they're reading.
Yeah.
And Alicent keeps it. And
okay.
I think it's supposed to be a, you know, let's remember when we were friends sort of thing, a signal to Rhaenyra. I was wondering if if people would get that. It took me a second to remember where it was from. And then I had to watch it a second time and be like, what is this? Like, where has this come from? And then you look on the internet and it's like, oh yeah, of course. And so, yeah, I don't know if maybe another shot of the page would have been helpful midway through the season.
Maybe, but I think it's okay to not spell these things out, to not have, like, I feel like another show would do a little flashback where it's all in like hazy soft focus and it's like, it's all coming back to me now. And no, you don't need to do that. We're in the age of the internet. Like, you can look these things up, it's fine.
Which I did. A bit of extracurricular work. But I think there are some people who, I mean, it's quite a few people actually, who read into some of the undertones of Rhaenyra and Alicent's relationship when they were younger, that there were elements of it that were slightly romantic. They just weren't allowed to really come to the fore. And I think there are a lot of people who believe that and read that into the story. And I can see why people would. I think that they were definitely excited to see this page again, because I mean, I think I've mentioned it on this show before that, like, Gretchen Felker-Martin, she was one of these people who thought that Rhaenyra and Alicent, there was more going on there beneath the surface than maybe we were privy to in the show. And she summed it up brilliantly by saying, like, you know, House of the Dragon has kind of become about people who wanted to fuck Rhaenyra and didn't get to, people who, like, did and wish they hadn't, and that sort of thing. And I think, yeah, she was definitely nice. But I imagine she would have been excited to see that page again as a little reminder of what once was and what never was, unfortunately.
Totally.
I understand we have a new king.
A stranger casts a long shadow over this family. Your brother is also dead. In his haste to bury you and claim your seat, he stood before the king and denounced Laenor's sons as illegitimate. Daemon took his head for it.
Heedless ambition has always been a Velaryon weakness. You are right, Rhaenys. I reached too far. And for nothing. Our pursuit of the Iron Throne is at an end. We shall declare for no one. We will retire to high tide to be content with our grandchildren.
In part three, Lord Corlys Velaryon wakes up from his fever and begins his recovery. He and Rhaenys agree to stop pursuing the Iron Throne and back Rhaenyra's claim instead. Corlys reveals to Rhaenyra's council that he has seized the Narrow Sea and destroyed the Triarchy for good. Rhaenyra agrees to send her sons as envoys to the Vale, Winterfell, and Storm's End. Lucerys is sent to Storm's End with terms for Lord Boros Baratheon, who bent the knee to Rhaenyra 20 years ago. Meanwhile, Daemon enters the caves of Dragonstone in his attempts to bring the three wild dragons to heel so that Rhaenyra may use them as part of her war effort. I don't have many notes about this part of the episode.
Neither do I. Go on, but go on.
It was just the thing about Corlys and Otto being kind of paralleled a little bit. They're the two characters from outside of Rhaenyra's little circle that come into this episode. And I don't know... Well, I didn't know at first why. And then I realised that it was like, it's the two men who have kind of used their children to push themselves towards power. And in the last episode where Otto kind of went deeper into his darkest impulses in order to crown Aegon as king, Corlys has taken the moment
and the illness and stuff to sort of back away a little bit and acquiesce slightly. You know, that the fever has probably caused him to be a bit, you know, he's kind of recognized his own mortality. Let's not push too hard. You know, what, you know, all this, like, you know, pursuit of legacy and all this stuff. Like, it seems like he's cooled down on it a little bit. You know, it's just, we have grandchildren. They may not be of true Valyrian blood or whatever, but they have our names. And so let's, you know, let's back them instead of worrying too much about, like, you know, oh, I must have, you know, one of my children married to somebody important so that they can do this and they can do that and that sort of thing. And so it's nice that in this episode we see the paths that Otto and Corlys have kind of gone down together. I don't know how effective that parallel has been throughout the season or whether that was even the intention, but I just think, you know, that they're two men who are not in Rhaenyra's inner circle who've appeared in this episode from, like, other camps. They, you know, they've come from other camps and they've, but both of their respective journeys have been played out, have been laid out in front of us here.
Where, yeah, that's a good point.
Otto has carried on with his intentions and Corlys has backed away. What notes do you have about this part of the episode?
The mention of the triarchy, I feel like that's kind of been one of the weak points of the season, that it just keeps coming up, but then nothing really comes of it. And yeah, it's like, oh, the Stepstones and the Triarchy and they're back again, but then they're gone again. And now this is like, they're putting it to bed, but it's like, did this really achieve anything?
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I think it's because most of it's happened off screen. Like, with the crab feeder, it was like, oh, well, here's the villain guy. And then they killed him. And it was like, oh, well, yeah, you know, pretty cool. Like, you know, I guess that's the end of that then. And then they've been mentioned a couple of times since without any real clear reason why. You know, it could have been any other army. It could have just been, like, oh, I don't know, Lord Corlys is off again. I don't know where he's gone. You know, he's been injured. He's got a fever. I don't know. He's off traveling the world. But it's just they have to keep mentioning the triarchy. And it's like, weren't we done with this, like, 6 weeks ago now in the show anyway? And obviously about 15 years ago in the show. Yeah, I think it's probably, they probably put it in because it was like, well, we need to explain why Corlys is away. We can't have him fighting a new enemy or something like that. And so, fine, we'll just put the triarchy in there. But I feel similarly to you where it's like they keep mentioning this, but I'm not getting much emotion out of it, to be honest. It kind of feels like a little punchline. Like, maybe this is something they'll just keep bringing back throughout the show where the triarchy will just keep getting mentioned as this bad smell that just won't go away.
Maybe. But yeah, I think with Corlys, like, I didn't get much of a stir out of him coming back either because, again, he's not been on screen. If it was like, I don't know, he was gravely ill or something and we saw it and we kind of checked in periodically and it's like, he looks like he's not going to pull through, but then he does. Kind of, you know, like Viserys in episode 8, where it looks like it's the end, but then he comes back for one big triumphant kind of last showing before retiring to bed and dying. It's like, yeah, it's just hard to get much emotion from something that has been off screen for the best part of the season.
Yeah, I agree, because Corlys's illness, if you will, it was something that kicked off episode 8, but that was sort of it. Like, it just, it kicked off the process for episode 8, but we never really, you know, it gets pulled away from that pretty much immediately. And it becomes about the ramifications of his potential death rather than spending time with him personally. But it's a minor note for me, but it is a note still, all the same. I think Emma Darcy has really come in to this role, like, just spectacularly.
Totally.
Yeah, I wanted to make a little note for them because I think this is, you know, the last time that we really see them in the episode, other than when Rhaenyra gets the news at the very end of the episode. But
yeah,
Millie Alcock had such a following on social media.
Oh, yeah.
Like, huge. And so to the point where, like, the person stepping into that role after her was going to have a huge task. And I think Emma Darcy, they've just picked it up and they've added weariness and just this kind of this sense of being slightly beaten down and exhausted by everything. And
yeah,
there's a tiredness to Rhaenyra, which I really love that Emma brings. And there's a real sympathy to Rhaenyra in this episode. And a lot of people have already kind of brought up the comparison between Rhaenyra in this episode and Daenerys in like episode 4 of the last season of Game of Thrones, where it's like we've had all this stuff happen to us and we've just kind of reached the limit now. We've snapped. And we see Rhaenyra go from one end of the spectrum to the other, where, you know, she finds out that her dad's dead, and then she finds out that Aegon has been crowned instead of her, and they've mm-hmm. betrayed her father's wishes. And you're like, okay, still not going to go to war, though. Still don't want to go and attack anyone. And then she loses a child, and it's like, oh, well, you know, still can't go to war, can we? And then when she's sending Luke and Jace and sending them all off to various castles as envoys rather than warriors and stuff, and it's like, you know, her intentions right up to that point are still trying to keep the peace, trying to defend herself from potential attacks as opposed to making attacks of her own. And when she sends the kids off, I noticed, I don't know if you did, that they play a variation of the theme that plays when Daenerys arrives at Dragonstone in season 7.
I didn't notice that, but that's a really good spot.
And so it feels a little bit like they've been bleeding Daenerys into Rhaenyra in this episode ever so slightly, where there's just little bits and pieces that get sort of like nudged in at a time, and by the end of the episode it's like they do the face that they've now found. You know, there's the Targaryen smile, and now it seems that there's the Targaryen frown as well, with Rhaenyra at the end of the episode and Daenerys being paralleled when Missandei is beheaded at the end of towards the end of Game of Thrones, where they do the same face, and it's the I've tried to hold my nerve for just as long as I possibly can, and now I've snapped face. And so
yeah, it's the Chris Morris, yes, that's it. It's war.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that is exactly it. It is that face. And Emma, beforehand, the way that they track Rhaenyra's journey across this episode, just with the sweet, kind of sympathetic face. And because I do think, like, Emma in character as Rhaenyra, like, Rhaenyra has this kind of look where, for me, I just go like, oh, aren't you sweet? You know, I don't know what it is, but like, I feel...
Yeah, there's a kind of softness. As much as there is a weariness, it's like, you ultimately get this sense that deep down, they are a lovely person. But I think that, I'm glad you mentioned that weariness, because it is kind of like being anywhere near the throne is just this curse, which turns you into like the picture of Dorian Gray.
Yeah. No, exactly. And like, well, we're going to see the implications of that very soon.
I came as a messenger, not a warrior.
Fight would be little challenge. No. I want you to put out your eye. It's payment for mine. One will serve. I would not blind you. Plan to make a gift of it to my mother.
No.
Then you are craven as well as a traitor.
Not here. Give me your eye, or I will take it, bastard. Not in my hall.
In part 4, at Storm's End, Luke arrives on the back of his dragon Arax during terrible weather. Upon his arrival, he notices that Aemon's dragon Vhagar is already there, indicating that Aemond has already met with Lord Boros. Nonetheless, he enters the castle. Lord Boros rejects Rhaenyra's terms, siding with Aegon the King instead. As Luke turns to leave, Aemond demands that Lucerys remove his own eye. Lucerys refuses the demand and attempts to flee with Arax. While in the air, he is chased by Aemond on the much older, much larger Vhagar. Although Aemond is only teasing Lucerys, Arrax panics and breathes fire at Vhagar, which enrages Vhagar. Despite Aemond trying to bring her under control, Vhagar chases down Arrax and bites her in half, killing Lucerys as well in the process. And at Dragonstone, Daemon informs Rhaenyra that her son is dead. Then the storm broke and the dragons danced, which is one of my favourite lines from Fire and Blood. The maester that George R. R. Martin is pretending to be. That's how he ends the chapter. That incident happens. It's a great line. So
yeah, awesome.
I wanted to give a quick shout out to something that Jay said. We've not got Jay's thoughts on the episode. We know that he liked it a lot. But beyond that, we don't have many thoughts of his. He has been very busy. Although he did say that the shot of Vhagar against the lightning was very kaiju, Godzilla.
That's true.
That is exactly how you introduce the monster in like Godzilla or something like that, where you just see the silhouette against the clouds, like, and the lightning and the rain, like, like that. And he's, oh God, shit. Jesus, that's huge, isn't it? So, Lucerys arriving at Storm's End, how are we with all of this? Before the dragon flight, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think the sight of Vhagar would kind of be enough to maybe make him rethink this strategy. But yeah, it is a moment of, you know, Luke kind of worrying about how he'll take up this role. And it's just a shame that this is the moment of, like, finally realizing that he can do this and he can kind of fill those boots if he just kind of puts his mind to it. And he can display that strength and bravery required of him. But it just, obviously, we know how it ends. And yeah, it's like we're coming to Lord Boros Baratheon, and it's clear, like, from the offset that this is not going to end well. But just persevering with it in the face of, like, overwhelming odds, it's, yeah. Of all the moments for you to finally prove that you're up for the role, and this is how it ends.
Yeah, I think the words that Rhaenyra said to him earlier in the episode are probably ringing in his ears.
Mm.
Where she says, you know, it's his duty to do this. And he thinks, okay, let's carry on.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it ends up where he meets Aemond at his most kind of anime villain. Like, the fucking sapphire. Like, it's just...
I know.
The eye patch, it is like, you know, it is a bit... You know, just from stuff when I was watching as a kid and stuff like that, it does feel like, you know, this is someone you'd really dislike in an episode of Yu-Gi-Oh! Or something like that, where he just has this card and it's like, it's the I use this and I put this down and this will happen. And you're like, oh no. It's like the kind of villain that would be given a 2-episode arc in Yu-Gi-Oh! As opposed to just the one.
Yeah, definitely.
Where he wins at the end of one episode and it's a bit of a cliffhanger. Just excited to see Storm's End from the outside. That's the first time that's ever happened in this universe.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
We saw it from the inside earlier in House of the Dragon. We never went there in Game of Thrones. So here we are. Very good to see that. But yeah, the stuff after in the sky, I've been waiting for this. Because this is one of my favourite little bits from the book. This is like the, oh shit, like, you know, this is what's going to ignite the war. Like, this is it. This is the first blood that spilled in the Dance of the Dragons. And I love that they've reframed it. I don't know what you thought about how this scene played out with, like, Aemond wanting to tease and chase and maybe frighten Lucerys but not kill him, but then that ends up happening anyway. Like, what are your thoughts on all the stuff that happens in the sky?
Well, I mean, I think I said to you that I wasn't a huge fan of the actual chase scene just because... not because of anything to... How do I put this? More from, like, a production standpoint of just... I can't make out what's going on, and a lot of this show is about kind of, we've explained it before with the darker shots and like how you can't really tell people's expressions because there's so much happening, and I've never really got much out of the action sequences. They like this, they feel a bit kind of Harry Potter to me. I can take or leave it. But yeah, I do love this angle that, you know, he was just intending to maybe not kill him, but name him, for example. It's like a show of strength rather than actually trying to ignite a war.
Yeah, posturing.
And yeah, absolutely, posturing. And I think even with the eye thing, like, if, you know, if it was just a case of an eye for an eye, would that really satisfy Aemond? I don't think it would.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I do think that Aemond definitely wants Luke to give his eye up, but he may see that as justice done. But, like, the thing with Aemond in this, for me, though, is just, yeah, how the posturing just goes too far. And I'm really curious about how he's going to play it when he gets back to King's Landing, where I imagine in public he's going to be like, yeah, I killed that motherfucker, watch out for me, Aemond one eye with a sapphire in my eye, you know, watch out for me when you're walking past, you know, that sort of thing. But then privately to Alison, he'll just go, Mum, you know that you sent me to Storm's End, and, well, there was an incident with the dragons, and it's a funny story, you're not going to believe this. But and so I do think that, yeah, the reframing of history is exactly what makes this sing for me. Because I agree with you. I think some of the action sequences on the dragons so far in this show have been a bit janky.
Just, yeah, the dragons look a bit rubbery as well. Yeah,
yeah, the dragons look, I'm kind of, you know, making my peace with how they look in the show, because they were just exemplary in Game of Thrones. The production design with the dragons in Game of Thrones was fantastic. Whereas with this show, they're just pretty good. You know, they look a bit rubbery. You can tell that they're there, but I think some of the shot choices were a little bit janky as well. But I will say that the one shot that really got me was Arrax flying in the clouds, and then Vhagar
just above
appears.
The clouds. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And then Vhagar appears above her, above Arrax, and then they get above the clouds. And it's
kind of like in
daylight.
The Long Night. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It did remind me of The Long Night, too. Yeah, that's a really good spot. But then, yeah, this reframing, like, Luke's death being an accident, it just makes the sense of tragedy a bit stronger. Because in the books, obviously nobody's there. This is all based on reports. And so, in the books, it's basically Aemond was really, really angry and chased Luke into the sky and just killed him. Like, the dragons fought, and he was angry, and he killed him. Whereas the show has reframed it. They've used that little gap in history to, as if it's a mistake. It's not something that they intended to happen. It was like, oh, shit. Like, because you can see it on Aemond's face. It's just like, shit, I've just started a war. Oh, fuck. Oh, Jesus. And he's still, you see that little boy in there somewhere. You do see that with Aemond a couple of times, where it's like, he is just a little boy. Still, there's all of this stuff is just posturing. He's really good with a sword, and, like, he looks cool as fuck, and he's got this sapphire in his face, but inside he is still that little boy who kind of knows how to control his dragon, but not really, not fully. And I just love the fact that, like, the rest of the show that we're going to watch, the war that starts because of this incident, the incident was an accident. And
yeah,
It reminds me a lot of, like, what happened in episode 8 with Viserys, where it's like the conflict kind of begins because, you know, Alicent misinterpreted some deathly ramblings from Viserys, and now this time we get a total accident where this little boy wanted to basically tease another, a younger boy, with his big dog, and then the big dog got off the lead somehow. And yeah, it's great. I think it's such a great decision. The adaptive changes they've made, on the whole, in this show have been very good. I think the changes they've made from text to show, the conversation that the show is having with the book is really interesting. And I'm keen to see little things that they change about the future that, you know, fans who've read the book will just take as gospel because, oh, it's George R. R. Martin's word, it's in the book. And so I'm curious to see. I was wondering if, because Fire and Blood is built up of three different perspectives, and I was wondering, what I was looking forward to was picking which perspective they were going to go with at different moments.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, because there's Mushroom that likes to cause all the... he likes to cause all the mischief. He likes to gossip about history. But then you got Septon Eustace that has his own biases but tries to be more objective. And like, I was curious to see which perspective they were going to go with. And with this one, they don't really have anybody's perspective. And so the show isn't necessarily saying what we choose is canon. It's just that it's noticing a gap in the history that's not been filled in by anybody's perspective or the truth. You know, all the witnesses, you know, one of them's dead and the other one's never going to tell the truth. And so they can do what they want with that. And it's good that's a good instinct, I think. That's a good writing instinct, that. And I've been really, impressed with those kinds of things. And then we get back to Dragonstone. Do you have any more to say about Emma Darcy's, just their face? I know we talked about it before, but...
I feel like you've already summed it up perfectly. It's the Targaryen... Okay, well, now I have to do this face.
Yeah, pretty much.
I have no choice, sort of thing.
Yeah. All right, then. I want your favourite line of the episode, Lizzie.
My line of the episode is from Daemon, who says, "Dreams didn't make us kings. Dragons did."
Yeah, I was kind of waiting for that to come up in the show, because that's one of the... I think that's the first line of dialogue we ever got from the show, because it was in that teaser trailer in October 2021. So about this time a year ago, and we finally hear it.
I haven't actually seen that. I can go back and watch it now.
Yes, you can, because the big spoiler was... because it came out before we finished Game of Thrones, and there was a Game of Thrones spoiler in it.
Yeah, I remember you saying.
200 years before the fall of the throne. And I was like, oh, shouldn't really say anything to Lizzie about the fall of the throne. That might get ahead thinking too much, so yeah, I'm going to spoil you on that one, so you can go back and watch that to your heart's content. Who is the loser this week for you?
My loser of the week is Aemond Targaryen.
Okay, that's a first vote for Aemond for loser of the week. And who is your last winner of the season?
Go on then, one for the road. It's Lucerys Targaryen.
Ah, we hardly knew ye, even through all the time jumps.
I know. Never mind.
Okay, so we won't be back next week because there's no more episodes to talk about. But we are going to do, with Jay, we are going to do a season review like we used to for Game of Thrones, where we'll run through a few categories, pick our favourite episodes, favourite moments, favourite characters, least favourite characters, you know, all the sorts of things that we used to do. I'm also working on a couple of interviews with people from the show behind the scenes. One of them... is with Kieran Belshaw, who we've chatted to on the show before, who did production design and art design for season 5, 6, 7 and 8 of Game of Thrones, and stayed on to do production design work for season 1 of House of the Dragon. And the other that I'm kind of working on, if it happens, you will obviously hear about it on the show. If it doesn't, I will let you know that what we tried to do and ended up not happening. Hopefully it will, fingers crossed. It will either pop up in your feeds and you'll be very excited, or it won't pop up in your feeds and you'll just have to wait for me at some point to tell you. So yeah, thank you very much for listening to all of our coverage of House of the Dragon this season.
Thank you.
Just thanks to Jay as well, because, like, you know, it was a bit of an experiment for us to get a third voice in, someone who knows the text way better than I do, who's more of a book person than a show person. To get a nice balance of perspectives, and it's all been, I think it's worked out really nicely, and it's worked out really well. It's been a lot of hard work, you know, running, me and Lizzie kind of running two podcasts at the same time, because we also run a British pop music podcast. It's called Hits 21. I'll leave a link to that in the description. And so getting all the editing done for two podcasts has been pretty tough, and recording for both has been tough on us both. And to be honest, I'm kind of glad for the break. But it's been a lot of fun, and when House of the Dragon started, I was living in one place, and now it's ended, I live in another. I've moved house during this season, which I'll always associate now with this first season, like where I was and what I was doing. Yeah. And thank you, Lizzie, for joining us for the dragon ride for House of the Dragon as well.
Yeah, no, thank you for everything that you do. I'm hoping that between that time, like, I'd love to talk about Succession again with you.
Yeah,
obviously I've been begging you to watch The Wire at some point, you know.
Mm. Sure, yeah, we can do little visits for Succession, The Wire. I don't know, we could get Jay to do an audiobook of Fire and Blood or something like that.
Ooh, yeah. Totally.
Yeah, we'll force him to do that. We'll hold him at knife point and be like, read that book. But yeah, cool. All right then. We'll see you when we see you.
See ya. To give to you, here come the planes. So you better get ready, ready to go. You can come as you are. And I said, okay, who is this really? And the voice said, this is the hand. Smoking or non-smoking?